Last week's election in Colombia has received little attention in Canada, but it is of great significance not only for Colombia, but for the entire region. The Vancouver Media Co-op caught up with Manuel Rosenthal, a Colombian surgeon and activist, to ask him his views on the importance of the March 14th legislative elections.
Extremely significant, not only for Colombia, but from Colombia for Latin America. The results in essence, and then a quick analysis on that. The president's party, Partido de la U, right-wing, linked to paramilitaries, most of the parliamentaries are in jail now. They won more seats than even than before. So the same paramilitary death squad, drug trafficking connected group won close to 30 seats in parliament. And then the other three parties connected to Uribe won just as many seats. And there's a new party called PIN, Partido de Integración Nacional, National Integration Party. And these are relatives of those who are former parliamentaries, parliamentarians who are in jail. And these people's relatives run, and they gain as many seats as the left opposition party won. Polo Democratic won 8 seats, and so did these people. Now, the other thing is that the Polo Democratico lost in relationship to the previous. It had become the main opposition party. Now it weakened a lot. And the former leftist mayor of Bogotá, Luis Eduardo Garzón, with Antanas Mockus, a liberal, rightist liberal with sort of a green speech, and Peñalosa, three former mayors of Bogotá, formed a new party, exploited sort of a center ideology, which is really a right ideology, but pretending not to be Uribistas, and they were the surprise of this election. So, in essence, the analysis that people are making is this. Number one, Uribe has succeeded in remaining in power. Two, the model that Uribe represents, which is a coalition of mafias, drug traffickers, landlords, and transnational corporations, is establishing itself through an electoral process that they call democratic. There's fraud, corruption, intimidation, and manipulation through propaganda like nowhere else, which allows them to commit to become the most illegitimate government in power and then the most popular one and be elected and gain more position. Two, Polo Democratico, the alternative party from the left, exposed grave mistakes and people punished them for them. And what were the mistakes? Simply this. They had a position from the left, clearly against free trade agreement and the free trade model. Gustavo Petro, the current candidate for Polo, stood for a position of alliance with the right in order to defeat Uribe. An alliance with the right means sacrificing your position of the left to join the right. So the answer in Colombia, like in Chile recently, is the same. If you are to vote for the right, you vote for a rightist. But if you're going to vote for a right, you don't vote for the left. If the left is not the left anymore, then we might as well vote for the right. That's what happened in Chile and that's what happened in Colombia. Why can I say it so strongly? For one reason. One of the candidates that won more votes than ever in the history of the left in Colombia this time, within this scenario, is Jorge Enrique Robledo, who is the single figure that stands more strongly in that country for a position from the left, for the left, and against the economic model. Whereas Petro's friends, and he's the leader of the party now, almost all of them lost, or won through corruption, manipulation, and so on. So the situation in Colombia now is that we will have another 4 years of delivering the country to transnational corporations, of rampant corruption and delivering the national resources into private hands, like Agroingreso Seguro, the huge scandal where the funding for the poor peasants was transferred to drug dealers and beauty parlors and so on. And finally, we will have, most likely, and this is the most frightening scenario, we're going to get closer and closer to an armed conflict in the region. an armed conflict from Colombia against Venezuela and Ecuador, which is what Uribe has been after, which is what Juan Manuel Santos, the current candidate and former minister of defense, is after, and which is what the Americans want, because if there was a war in the Andean region, they could access the oil and activate the economy through the main sector of their economy today, which is the military-industrial complex. So Colombia has become a threat to the whole region and a model, a successful model for the right, where you can, in fact, manipulate 44 million people into becoming a fascist state at the service of transnational corporations and mafias. And that's what's empowering Colombia now.
I asked Rosenthal who he thought would be elected president on May 30th.
Most likely, given the results of these elections, it will be Juan Manuel Santos. And he inherited Álvaro Uribe's, the leadership of his main party. There's still a possibility that his former Minister of Agriculture might compete for that. And Uribe would have liked his former minister because he's much more corrupt and much more linked to the paramilitary. But one has to remember Juan Manuel Santos is directly responsible for the false positives, the assassination of innocent people presented then as members of the guerrilla. So we're going to have... The difference between Santos and Uribe is that he's worse than Uribe, and it's possible. Because he does come from the elites. He's acceptable for the U.S. oligarchy and elites. He's acceptable for the transnational corporations. He comes from El Tiempo and the big media. He's big money. He's not an outsider like Uribe was. So he has all the power and all the cultural background to actually launch a war in the continent and to lie. He is a much better liar than Uribe. He can say the most outrageous things as though they're truth, and he'll probably win. So resistance in Colombia is going to become even harder and stronger. And I have to say something here. I mean, if the left had the democratic left had become stronger in Colombia, Santos weakened, and Polo an option for the presidential election, then there would have been another loser in Colombia, and that's FARC. Because, I mean, not in ideological terms, but in strategic terms, the presence of FARC and their actions today, rather than political actions to achieve political goals, these are military actions and terror, and people vote for the right because they want to get rid of FARC. And FARC, according to many of those who have been kidnapped and do analysis on this, FARC would rather have Uribe or Juan Manuel Santos as a president because they don't lose their visibility. But if you have somebody from the democratic left, they lose their visibility and the social movements gain strength. So we'll have more war, we'll have more polarization. You're either with FARC or with the government. We'll have more delivery of the country to transnational corporations, and the Colombia model will continue to be exported, as is the case in Mexico today. Mexico is a Colombia exported to Mexico, as is the case in Afghanistan, which is Colombians are advisors in Afghanistan. And most likely, continued discrediting of Chavez in Venezuela, an attack against Evo Morales, who's a very, very problematic president for the regime, and maybe a war in the region, which is frightening.
Given the likelihood of increasing displacement, paramilitarization, and terror, I asked Rosenthal to describe the situation for indigenous peoples and peasants in Colombia.
Increasingly, particularly, as you know, indigenous peoples had a clearer and clearer understanding that this wasn't a struggle against the landlord owners alone or the local power broker. It was a struggle against an economic model. And they developed an agenda and started convening action from the whole country against that agenda. So Cauca, for example, the heart of the resistance in Colombia, has become the main target of a comprehensive aggression to destroy the process. Plan Colombia Phase 2 is being implemented in northern Cauca specifically, which means on the one hand they bring money for economic development projects linked to agribusiness or agrofuels, and on the other hand, war. So it's carrot and stick. You either work for a large transnational corporation producing what they want, and mining and water, etc., or we'll hit you with a stick and displace you from there. So under those circumstances, and one has to be honest about this, under those circumstances, then there's a tendency among certain leaders of indigenous movements and others to move towards the right, rather than fighting against the system and resisting the system. They want positions within the system, maybe at most to get some benefits for their own people. So if you can get a little access to healthcare, or if you can get a position in government, then you're willing to give up this or that. So we're seeing that weakening of the leadership of social movements. A clear example with the elections, to go back to our beginning. Aida Quilqué was the leader of the Minga, the woman who led the whole process, who people around the country loved, and they loved the Minga as well. There was one condition: this is not to be used for electoral purposes. There were at least 60,000 people in 2008 when the Minga took place. You say if half of them, the ones within, vote, she's already in parliament, because that's what she needs. That's 30,000. Less than 30,000 votes would get her in. Well, she ran against the will of her people. She didn't have a clear program. And people punished her because she got 14,000 votes, was not elected. But I don't think she or the other leaders in the process are going to be willing to learn and be humble and say, you know why we lost? Because we didn't listen to people. And we... Indigenous peoples are disciplined, and usually when their leadership says we're going to vote for this candidate, they vote for this candidate because it's coherent with their position. When they don't vote, it's because there is an inconsistency. They're telling them to vote for something that is contradictory to the agenda of the Minga. And that's exactly what happened. The five-point agenda of the Minga, comprehensive against the model, was transformed for a more comfortable agenda in order to get Aida elected. So those who were elected from the indigenous leadership are absolutely allied to the right. ASI, the Alianza Social Indígena, the indigenous party in Colombia, ran for as candidate and elected Marcos Avirama. And Marcos Avirama had appointed Sergio Fajardo from the right in Antioquia, former mayor of Antioquia, as their presidential candidate. They barely got one seat in parliament. So we have one example of the disintegration of social movements and collective consciousness, and of the appropriation by a fascist model through popular vote. Now, what I have to say in the end is saying these people might look at Colombia as an exception and a strange thing. I've been talking to people like Raúl Sivecki, like Oscar Oliveira in Ecuador, in Bolivia, and other people in Ecuador, and I can tell you we are all reading the same thing. They used to steal some leaders of social movements. Now, the model, the strategy is so refined that they are stealing entire movements. They're being swallowed. The same people who used to work in social participation and popular education with the same kind of language and speech and methodologies are now working in NGOs that end up getting people involved in projects that are opposite to their interests, with one mentality: will I get food tomorrow? If I get food tomorrow, I'm going to follow this project. Whereas the strength of the struggles that led Chavez and Evo Morales and others to the presidents was, yes, we might eat on Sunday, the day of the election, if they buy us a plate with beans, but then we'll be hungry for the next 4 years. So we'd rather not eat on Sunday so that we can eat in the future. That has been inversed, and now people want to eat Sunday and starve for the rest of their lives. And that's the strength of that strategy.
Finally, I asked how resistance will adapt to the situation he described.
Well, if you can't eat, you can't eat. And if you don't have the resources, you don't have them. And I'll tell you what my honest and most blunt answer to this is. I think regardless of whether social movements move or whether ideologues develop an idea or political parties become the answer to the question or leaders have mobilized the movement or their new flags and new positions, I don't think that's going to move us. But the material limits to life and social existence. I think the economic model is dead. It's finished. It's in a crisis that it won't come out of. And so if it's in a disaster and disarray, its solution is accumulation by destruction. They're going to cause wars in order to diminish the number of mouths to be fed, diminish the number of consumers, and enrich a few so that they can keep accumulating. And that's the project now. And that's obviously a fascist project. We're back to 1938, worldwide. So good if there's climate change and there is flooding all over the place and people have to be displaced and they die like flies. Perfect, because we can take over those territories and build resort hotels and so on. That's one part of it. But the other one is the failure of the economic system, leading to more and more poverty and so on. So that will lead people sooner or later to realize that it's either we change this whole system and establish a completely different one, not hierarchical, in harmony with nature, or we all die and disappear. And so that question is not even a rhetorical, political question anymore. It's an ecological question. Either we do it or we die. And we've been breaking our heads for years saying which kind of system will change and what ideas to teach people. Now, people will have to learn. When you go to plant a crop, in September, maize, in South America, in the Andes, and you can't plant a crop in September because it doesn't rain, and then it maybe rained in July when it shouldn't have, and it will rain again in January when it's supposed to be dry, then you realize, I can't even grow food. And when you connect that to what's going on with this system which actually led to this destruction, you say, man, either we stop and protect this world or we're all dead. So I think that's where it's going to come. And people, this whole struggle against the mega projects, the extractive industries, against the recognizing climate change and the destruction of the planet, all these things together with increased impoverishment, massive displacement, and the outpouring of lies. I mean, we are dying, and the newspaper is telling us that we're okay and we're happy. I mean, for now it's worked. The same fool that is reading the front page where he sees his own picture saying, I am happy, will look at that picture and say, but I'm not. I may look great in the front of the newspaper, but I'm actually embittered, lonely, starving, and this world is going nowhere. So I think that image gives you the idea of what I think is going to have to happen. And we count on one background, which is all these social movements like the NASA people in Cauca, like the water war in Bolivia or the Coca war, or like the MST, and the millions of social movements we don't even know about. The women in Peru with the collective cooking and all that stuff, and all Guatemala, everywhere. All those people, they ignore the nobodies, the non-existent. They already know this stuff. It's the middle class that has to learn it. They know, but they've been crushed. If there's any crack and they can get up, they will. And that's what's going to happen, I think.
You've just heard from Dr. Manuel Rosenthal, a surgeon and activist from Colombia, speaking in Toronto on March 19th, 2010.